And welcome back to the Bill Bennett Show podcast that takes a look at the news of the day. Try to have thoughtful conversations about things that matter. Existential threats to America, to Ukraine.
Right.
Talk about that today. Joining me today is Dan Katz. This is a little different focus for us, Claude.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's a co-founder and portfolio manager at Amber Wave Partners. This is an investment firm focused on a values-based investing ecosystem designed to influence corporations and the economy for the benefit of communities across the country and for all Americans. Dan was a senior advisor at the United States Department of Treasury from September 2019 to January 2021. I want you to listen to him. He's an interesting fellow.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
These guys have something. Don't be bothered by the word ecosystem.
Right.
First, there's a few things I'd like to discuss. Claude, let's talk a little bit about Ukraine.
Okay.
We're sitting here doing the show right on the heels of Zelensky's address to Congress.
Right.
Standing ovation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Same thing he got in Canada. And he is very impressive. As I've said before, you watch him with Dancing with the Stars, Ukraine. terrific. He's a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
But he's risen to the occasion.
Sure.
Some are born great. Some achieve greatness. Some have greatness thrust upon them, Shakespeare says. This is a very impressive fellow. He wants a lot from us, and we should give him a lot. We should have given him a lot sooner.
Right.
We can't give him the no-fly zone. Do you understand why?
Absolutely. I mean, you give him the no-fly zone, Putin's going to fly a plane over the no-fly zone, and you're going to have to shoot it down. You do that, that is seen as a clear act of aggression against Russia in the start of World War III.
Right. And there's a reason we can't start a World War III. Do you know what that is?
Well, we're not sure where other nations such as China, Iran, North Korea falls. Do we have the wherewithal to be able to lead a world effort against those countries? Don't know.
We don't win. I'm not sure we win a missile war with Russia. I've been checking the facts, talking to our friend Brian Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
They have more warheads than we do, more missiles than we do. And get this, 70% of the Russian people are protected by a missile defense system. About in America, about 5%.
Wow.
West Coast from North Korea. Mm-hmm. Not protected from Russian missiles. If we got into a shooting war with missiles, you and I are gone.
Right.
D.C.'s gone.
Yeah.
New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where else. Because we can't defend it. Now, I got on a tear on this last night on Brett Baer's show, special report on Fox.
My favorite news show, period.
You like it.
Cable and network, Brett Baer's show is the best one.
Here's why. Ronald Reagan started Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars is maybe what won the Cold War. Gorbachev and Reagan were meeting in Iceland. Gorbachev said that a condition of his granting a lot of concessions was that we give up Star Wars. Reagan went back, talked to his team, President Reagan, and said, fill me in on the Star Wars. It was very nascent. I mean, it was very early on. But the idea of developing a missile defense system which would repel Russian missiles was attractive to some people. And it was being pushed, and Reagan bought the idea. And Gorbachev was terrified of the idea, just thinking, that's a deal ender because, man, they developed that. We have no bargaining power. They're invulnerable. However, Ronald Reagan left office. It kind of floundered during the Bush era, was totally ignored and even criticized, made fun of during Clinton and then later on Bush II. And not made fun of, but ignored, and then made fun of by Obama Biden. Biden has been opposed to these ideas of Star Wars missile defense since 1982, 40 years now. And then during Trump, there was the idea of the Space Force.
Space Force, yep.
Again, made fun of. Democrats made fun of it, not supported. We don't have a system like that. We should have a system like that. We should immediately increase defense spending, and a big chunk of it should go toward this end. Until we do, we can't help anybody with a no-fly zone because we can't take that chance. I And now the whole world knows we can't take that chance. Mm-hmm. And that's a dangerous admission of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. We have the wrong president. The Ukrainians are blessed with their president. As I said the other night on one of these shows, I said, it was right after the State of the Union. What do you think of Biden's State of the Union? I said, all things considered, I'll take Zelensky. No, this is a shameful thing. And other stuff. Let's just talk about Biden for a minute at home. Gasoline, now blaming it all on Putin. Mm-hmm. Doesn't think the American people have any memory at all.
Well, the prices were going up before the Russia invaded Ukraine. We know this. We know these things.
Country is soured on him, and country thinks wrong direction is something like 70%.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I think he reached upper 30s as far as approval, and they were happy about this. But it's only because of the war. Like, it's not because of anything. Things are getting better here.
Yeah,
domestically.
No, it jumped up like 6-7 points, but then it's dropped back down.
And they were, you know, happy days are here again. Well, no, that's still a low number. It's just raised because no one's paying attention to what's happening here because of, you know, if it takes that to make people happy with your presidency, are you really a good president?
Who the heck are they going to put up, by the way?
Hillary Clinton.
I guess they might.
Yeah, and so, you know.
I also heard Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
No,
I don't know if you.
Okay.
You know, I mean, nothing against her as a person. It's just I don't know if now's the time for, you know, if anyone thought President Trump was unqualified and President Obama didn't have enough experience, she's got less than both. So I don't know how you justify that. But and now's not the time in the world to have inexperience in that office.
Yeah. Anyway. We want to hear from you all out there on this, and we get great emails. So, but how do people get in touch with us?
BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
It's almost time for us to do another episode where we do emails and, you know, your thoughts and
Let's
stuff.
Let's do it.
We just, we'll go guest
Let's do
this.
It. Yeah, send us an email, folks. Yeah. Send us an email. Let's talk to Dan Katz. Podcasts have changed the way we get our news, entertainment, politics, everything. Mm-hmm. They've rewritten the script. Somebody said to me this morning, I don't read op-eds, but I do listen to podcasts. Mm-hmm. We hope you listen to this one. Well, there's another exciting development that's rewritten the script, too, and that's called Masterworks.
Okay.
Masterworks enables you to diversify your portfolio. This is for investors. Mm-hmm. And potentially protect it from market volatility. And you do so by investing in contemporary art with Masterworks.
Ah, okay.
Now, I'm not up on contemporary art, but boy, it's hot, and people love it. They're the fintech startup shaking up the alternative investing landscape. It lets you build a portfolio of fine art without spending millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Invest in Picasso, Warhol. Invest in paintings by iconic artists like these with Masterworks. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Masterworks has an industry-leading research team. And it's created the first and only platform where anybody can buy and trade shares of paintings, giving you the same access enjoyed by millionaires and billionaires for generations.
See, now you're talking my language, because I'm not a big art guy. Like, I sit there and I look at it, I don't get it. But I'm a money person.
Give it a try. Our listeners get priority access to their latest offerings at masterworks.art/bill.
Okay.
Masterworks.art/bill. Join a new generation of investors. This is a new deal, boy. This is the modern world. Join that new generation of investors at masterworks.art/bill. And folks, see important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer. Masterworks, give it a look. Well, let's welcome Dan Katz to the show, co-founder and portfolio manager at Amber Waves Partners. Dan, thank you for your time today.
Bill, how are you?
Good. Good deal. Listen, we want to talk about Amber Waves Partners because I am fascinated about this. Tell me what Amber Waves Partners is, who's involved in it, what's it about?
Sure. And so Amber Wave Partners is a new investment management firm that I founded along with two co-founders last year. And, you know, the common thread that the three co-founders have that led us to come together and found Amber Wave is that each of us has had extensive career in the financial services industry and in investing, as well as in economic policy. And so the three of us us actually met for the first time in 2020 when we were all serving as senior officials at the Treasury Department, helping to oversee some of the response programs to the unprecedented economic shock as a result of the COVID crisis. When we left government in the beginning of 2021, we each decided that, you know, it would be terrific if we could figure out some way to marry up our background in financial services, you know, with our passion for making a real impact on the lives of Americans through finance and through economics. And that led us to the impact investing movement, which is, you know, sometimes confused with the overall ESG movement or the environmental, social, and government movement. Now, ESG is a style of investing that has become extremely prominent in recent years. You know, by some measures, over $40 trillion in assets globally are incorporating ESG judgments into the investing strategy. And as a result, you see it, you know, very present in corporate boardrooms and in all the actions that corporations are taking. And so when we looked at ESG, what we found is that it is having a real impact on the world. But the issue from our perspective is that the impacts that ESG was trying to achieve are actually relatively narrow if you think about them, right? They are, you know, generally focused on the climate in particular, and then sometimes some other secondary considerations. And our perspective is that the environment is important. You know, environmental impact is something that everyone should be thinking about. But if we're really going to think about the things that have concrete, measurable impacts improving people's lives, you have to have a much broader framework than just focusing on ESG. And that's what led us to found Amberwave and to build the firm around this concept that we're calling not ESG, but JSG. So that's jobs, security, and growth. And those are the three pillars that we're trying to build our firm on, because we think that if we can identify companies that are doing positive things for jobs, security, and growth, the result is that investors are going to see outsized financial performance, because we think that companies that engage in those things and promote those activities generate better returns over time. And most importantly, we want to see jobs, security, and growth impacts in American communities, which we think are, you know, vital to improving everyone in America's lives. And those judgments need to be incorporated into corporate decision making, just like ESG factors have been incorporated into corporate decision making.
All right. Bear in mind, I am, when it comes to financial matters, a novice, a total naif. My chief financial advisor is my son. And I mean, I, not that he's not a good one. He's a good one, but I know nothing. But I've heard ESG before, and I've heard it mostly, Dan, from people I know in business, some in the oil industry and other industries like it. And they don't like ESG, and regard ESG as something that hampers what they're trying to do. And keeps them from developing in the way they would like. Well, what's their complaint, and is it legit?
When I think about it, you know, I think the complaints are legit, but the complaints are legit because the ESG is the only outside force that's exerting pressure on traditional corporate decision making.
Okay.
Right. No one is saying, and I'm sure those business leaders that you are referring to, no one is saying that the environment isn't important. Right. The environment is important.
Right.
But it can't be the only factor on which we're basing corporate decision making. So, you know, in our view, the issue is that ESG has developed into this catch-all for all considerations that companies should think about outside of traditional financial metrics. But we actually think that's very misplaced. And what's needed is a diversity of perspectives in the market for impact investing products so that ESG just becomes one piece of the overall puzzle, rather than the dominant one.
Let me press on this, and I don't want to lose job security and growth, but I'm just interested because I'm trying to learn more about this. Do you think we are, as a nation, as a world, in transition to cleaner energy?
Here's what I would say. I think that the transition is really going to be driven by technology more than anything else, right? I mean, the environmental improvements that we've seen in terms of emissions reductions in the Western world over the last 20 years, which have been dramatic, have primarily been driven by innovation in the fossil fuels, right? And it's been driven by the shale revolution. It's been driven by the rise of natural gas as a fuel source rather than coal. All of that has to do with technological improvements in the fossil fuel space. Renewables can certainly be part of the picture, right? No one is opposed to renewable energy if it's economic and a sensible approach for investors and for society. But the problem is a myopic focus on only renewables, regardless of cost. We should be letting technology and the market determine the path of our fuel sources moving forward, not by, just by fiat determining that we're going to make it difficult for fossil fuel production to occur.
Yeah, this is what we hear from the podium in the White House. Well, sorry about this. We know gas is expensive, but, we've made it plain from the beginning that we want to make transition to clean energy, so that's it, and that came down as a dictum, this is where we are, and this is the way we're going to do it. Whatever the technology dictates, we're going this way. Am I characterizing it correctly?
So I think there's no question that's been an element of the trend that we've seen, not just in terms of regulation, right, but also in terms of the financial sector and the investment profession, right? The rise of ESG has resulted in companies, including those in the fossil fuel industry, having a real hard time attracting financing, right? Because the message that the market and policymakers are sending is that fossil fuels are on their way out. The problem from our perspective as folks who are at Amberwave, who are focused on jobs, security, and growth, is that phasing out fossil fuel doesn't take account of the impacts on the jobs in the communities that depend on fossil fuel, right?
Sure.
And it also doesn't take account of the security implications associated with the U.S. having to depend on unreliable renewables right now and foreign energy exports.
Yeah.
Right? And so this dynamic that we've seen that has chilled investment in the fossil fuel space has left the United States extraordinarily vulnerable at this time to global energy markets, right? And the economic actors like Russia that power it. And unfortunately, there's really no quick fix to the current situation, right? Because investors who finance fossil fuel exploration are not just looking at returns on a 1 month or 3 month basis, right? No one starts a multi-billion dollar offshore energy project because of their expectations on the cost of gas today or tomorrow, right? That's why you need a stable regulatory and financing environment from the investment management profession that shows that these technologies and companies have a place in our economy moving forward. And that way, investors and companies that are engaged in fossil fuel production can have the confidence to invest not just for the next 3 months, but for the next 5 and 10 years.
Does Amberwave support investment in fossil fuel companies?
So our perspective at Amberwave on where fossil fuel fits in with jobs, security, and growth is really multifaceted. First of all, we're energy source agnostic, as long as it, fits the fundamental criteria, right? So it needs it's good for energy. So energy needs to be able to provide what's called baseload power, right? Which means that it's available 24 hours a day. That's something that nuclear does, right? Which is not fossil fuel. And we're very supportive of, investments in the nuclear industry. We're also supportive of investments in fossil fuels, because it's a critical American industry that's important to our security and that creates millions of jobs in our country that American communities rely on. And so when we carry out our investing strategy, we're really looking to identify the best of the best in the energy sector that are engaged in activities, including fossil fuel exploration, that is critical to U.S. jobs, security, and growth.
Great. Good. All right. So tell us more about job security and growth. You just illustrated it with the example of energy companies, fossil fuels. But tell us more in general. And how's AmberWaves doing? How is this program doing?
Sure. So the job security and growth investing strategy that we've developed is really designed to be, you know, a multifactorial, you know, highly individualized assessment that provides a holistic view of a company's contribution to U.S. job security and growth. And so when you go through each factor, what you see is that we've designed the factors to try to help us identify both companies that are going to be sources of outperformance over time and also have that job security and growth impact in American communities. So take the jobs factor, for example. You know, what we're looking for there is not just the numbers of jobs that companies are creating or the percentage of jobs in relation to the company's overall size that it's creating, but also where those jobs are created and for who they're created, right? Because it's important from the perspective of the overall labor market to have jobs available for folks who have a harder time transitioning into the labor market. So think new high school graduates or jobs in, you know, rural communities or inner cities that are relatively less underserved than, say, Silicon Valley or the New York metropolitan area. You know, we're also looking for the quality of the jobs are created, right? So we want to see jobs being created at companies that have high job retention rates, right, that are actually giving people the opportunity to build careers rather than churning through workers over and over again.
Okay.
And obviously that's going to have an impact on American communities because the existence of opportunity in the labor market is so fundamental to everyone's lives. But in addition, there is very good evidence that suggests that companies that score well on these factors are going to outperform over time, right? Because they're going to be able to attract better talent. They're going to be able to retain workers and grow. And, you know, the top economic studies in this area have shown that companies that perform well on these factors tend to generate between 200 and 350 basis points of outperformance over the market on an annual basis, which is very, very significant. So when we go through this highly individualized assessment, what we end up with is really the best of the best from a job security and growth perspective that we expect to outperform over time. And in terms of how we're doing, so our first financial product we launched about 2 months ago on January 19th. It's called the IUSA Exchange Traded Fund. So that's IUSA is the ticker, and it's available in everyone's brokerage accounts, or if you call your financial advisor, they'll be able to access it. And with IUSA, as I mentioned, we've picked the cream of the crop from a job security and growth perspective. And as a result, we've actually seen significant outperformance in our portfolio versus the broader market. So we're recording this on March 16th. And since inception of IUSA until today, we delivered approximately 200 basis points or 2% of outperformance against the S&P 500. Precisely because we're identifying, you know, the companies that have the most secure supply chains, the companies that are supporting U.S. security the most. And those companies are outperforming during this period of geopolitical turmoil we've seen.
Can you share with us what some of those companies are? Is that privileged?
Oh, no. So the way an exchange-traded fund works is that shares of the exchange-traded fund are traded on the stock exchange, right? So under the ticker IUSA, as I mentioned.
Right.
But the price of IUSA, right, the performance of IUSA is tied to the underlying stocks that AmberWave selects and puts into the portfolio.
Right.
Those stocks are fully transparent and available on our website at amberwavepartners.com or jsgfunds.com. And we disclose the portfolio every single day because we believe it's very important for impact investing strategies to be, you know, measurable and accountable and fully transparent. And so that's the approach. That's the approach we've taken.
Give us an example or two of a company or a stock that you've identified that is doing well.
Sure. So, you know, a great example is actually one from the retail space. And, you know, when we think about retail, we often think that, you know, the market has really been disrupted as people have moved to shopping online. But using our job security and growth analysis, we've actually identified a number of retailers that are contributing to U.S. job security and growth and have outperformed. One such example is a company called Tractor Supply Company, which some of your listeners may be familiar with.
Sure.
You know, Tractor Supply Company is an amazing firm. It's been growing on an annual basis, its workforce, by roughly 20% over the last 3 years. And what's so important from our perspective is the type of jobs it's creating, the places it's creating them, right? So they tend to be in more rural communities, which may have relatively less economic opportunity. And they just have, relative to the industry, you know, a very high employee retention rate and an important focus on creating entry-level positions for, you know, folks with who have recently graduated high school, for example. And as a result of their retention rate, those folks can move up through the company. And that's a company that just performed extraordinarily well. It's also very important for the security of the U.S. food supply. And our supply chains. And, you know, another example of that of that kind of dynamic would be a company called Mosaic, which is in the energy business, but in particular focuses on fertilizers. And given the all the disruption we've seen in the international agricultural grid space, including the fertilizer space as a result of the Russian conflict with Ukraine, that's a company that has outperformed handily, and we identified it precisely because of its contribution to U.S. supply chain and food security.
All right, so tractors and fertilizers. Sounds like you're smack dab in the middle of America.
So certainly, you know, we are looking for companies that are focused on, you know, rebuilding American industry, but our portfolio very much resembles the overall market in terms of our industry exposure. So we have the same amount of technology in IUSA as the S&P 500. It's roughly 29% of our portfolio. But our technology that we've included are only the best job security and growth scorers. And so we're giving you as much tech as the S&P 500 is giving you. We're just giving you better tech because it's technology companies that that are high job security and growth scorers.
No, I have no objection to being smack dab in the middle of America, my characterization, crude as it was. Because, I mean, I think there's a point here. This may be unrelated, but you're a smart guy. You can make a lot of connections fast. Paper I read about 2 years ago that pointed out that Trump country, that is where the president was very popular, was doing much better economically than blue country, the blue coast.
No, so look, we think it's important, you know, not just for the investment management community to espouse principles that are friendly with job security and growth, right? And therefore, you know, have a positive impact on people's lives, you know, but there's also a significant role for policy. And certainly, you know, when the founders of Amberwave have had the great honor and privilege of serving in government, we have tried to, you know, advance policies that are supportive of U.S. job security and growth. Right. And, you know, that at federal level, that at state level, that happens at the local level. And so it's a critical component to creating the conditions for prosperity and increases in Americans' quality of life.
Yeah, I'm not asking you how to vote and how you voted and where you vote in the future, but the point that this paper was making was, you know, maybe if you're graduating from Yale, that's where you went, right? Instead of going to Silicon Valley or L.A., maybe you ought to go to Tulsa. Now, I mean, if you graduate from Yale, you can get a big job. A lot of places make a lot of money. But let's say middle Americans graduating from college, from any college, maybe more opportunity in Tulsa than in L.A. Plus, you don't have the problem of not being able to buy a house, et cetera. Do you see what I'm after here?
Yes, very much. And certainly, you know, we strongly believe in reinvesting, you know, in all American communities, right? Not just on each coast. And I think some of the trends that you've seen during the pandemic, for example, right, with relocations from, states like California and New York to Florida and Texas and, other states in the Mountain West are part of the, increasing trend that we're seeing, which is that, it's critical to rebuild the economic health of all of our communities, not just areas that have done really well during the last 20 years.
This is fascinating. What about doing business with Russia or with China? Where are you guys on that?
Sure. So, just to back up even before the, most recent conflict with Russia, the way we think about international exposure and the way it's built into our job security and growth methodology is we're really looking to assess the level of risk that's posed by a company's operations outside of the United States, right? And so we tend to gravitate towards companies that have relatively more supply chains, right, and are relying more on domestic manufacturing and domestic sourcing than on China. So for example, Apple is a company that manufactures almost all of its products in China and other jurisdictions. Nike doesn't have a factory in the United States, right? It's getting the vast majority of its goods not even from China anymore, mostly from Southeast Asia. Those are companies that don't make it into our portfolio because we think they have huge supply chain vulnerabilities as a result of unpredictable geopolitical events. And so we focus instead on companies that have relatively more secure supply chains. And the auto industry is a good example of this. We don't have Ford or GM in our portfolio. We do have Tesla in our portfolio. And one of the reasons why we have Tesla and not Ford or GM is that Tesla has really been a leader in trying to have a more secure supply for semiconductors and other materials that are critical for auto manufacturing. And so when Ford and GM were struggling to source semiconductors last year and as a result had to take certain factories offline, you didn't see Tesla have to have those problems because they've planned and sourced out and been able to identify more secure sources for their semiconductors. And so geopolitical exposure and exposure to China and Russia can have a huge impact on investment performance. And that's part of the reason why IUSA, in our view, has outperformed over the last 2 months. In terms of businesses doing business in Russia or China, I think what you've seen in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and a lot of companies, not as a result of sanctions, but self-sanctioning, right? Like deciding of their own volition to stop doing business in Russia. That's a positive development, and it's important to corporate citizenship to make sure that that you're not aiding folks who are actively seeking to undermine the U.S. and do damage. I wonder when that logic is going to be extended to China, because certainly a lot of the corporate tie-ins that we've seen with the Chinese market raise very similar issues to the issues that are being raised in the Russia context.
Again, this may be a crude characterization, but I hear from you a kind of residual affection for America. But not just affection for America, confidence in America, confidence in American people and American industry and American supply chain. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Right. The U.S. economy is really one of the most extraordinary economic engines the world has ever seen. The resilience of our workforce because of our culture, our education system, our legal system. Our economy is highly developed and fine-tuned, and as a result, we expect it to continue to outperform over time as long as we get the rules and the incentives right. And so that's why it's important from our perspective, both to have a government that's supportive of job security and growth, and also financial markets that are supportive of companies engaging in U.S. job security and growth.
Pause right there. Is the government administration right now that we have in power supportive of job security and growth?
I think it really depends on the specific issue. But, I think if you step back and you think about what most Americans are experiencing right now, the kind of the number one issue is probably you'd probably point to is inflation, right? Even though we have a very strong labor market. And on that front, you know, there's no question that excessive fiscal stimulus last year, incredibly loose monetary policy from the Fed, and the overhang of government regulation preventing the supply side from expanding is what's driving the real and very serious increases in inflation that we've seen. And by the way, increases that we saw even before Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the most recent spike in energy prices. And so, you know, it is really critical for the government, including the Fed, to take action to try to reduce inflation, because the reality is real wages have declined over the last year, right? Despite the hot labor market, inflation has gone up by more than people's wages. And so people are, you know, now have lower standards of living than they did a year ago.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. So you have that confidence and the resilience of the American economy, resilience of the American people. What about the fact that, I don't know if it's true or if it's just, anecdotal. People don't want to work. People don't want to go back to jobs. They've gotten used to sitting at home and collecting checks. Is that your view of the American people, the American worker?
So I don't think that represents the American worker overall, right? Which is why if you look at the overall workforce, you know, you see a labor force participation rate in the low 60s, and you see a relatively low unemployment rate. So the vast, vast majority of Americans want to, hold gainful employment, want to work hard, and are optimistic of the future. But what drives a lot of the growth figures, inflation figures, labor force participation figures is in fact that marginal individual. And on that point about marginal individuals, you know, there's no question that that the excessive savings that have built up in the system as a result of some of the fiscal stimulus that was done last year are probably deterring some people from coming back to the labor market. And so, you know, the U.S. should have hot labor markets and attractive labor markets because of the fundamentals of the economy. It shouldn't have hot labor markets because the government has paid people to stay home, right? That's not a recipe for having healthy growth and with reasonable inflation over time. I do think it's important that we right size the incentive structure to make sure that we're drawing the marginal person into the labor force rather than incentivizing them to not seek employment.
What should the Fed be doing right now? Should we be looking at 5 or 6 raises over the next year or not?
Sure. So the market's actually pricing in 7 rate hikes as of this morning over the next year. And, you know, in terms of 5, 6, 7, you know, my perspective on that is actually that the Fed has created much too much of an image that it's omnipresent and it somehow is going to know the right path of monetary policy well into the future, right? This is a business that the Fed got into over the last 10 years or so called forward guidance. And really what that was an attempt to do was to tell the market that the Fed was omniscient and therefore would never have to raise rates in the future as a way to encourage people to invest more and spend more. My perspective is, it is very difficult to know what the future of the economy holds, which is precisely why you've seen such a dramatic miss, not just amongst the Fed, but amongst most economic forecasters over the last year about how long and how high inflation was going to be. So my preferred path would be for the Fed to clearly acknowledge the mistakes that it's made in the past and to move very quickly to normalize monetary policy, which means normalizing the balance sheet and also raising rates. But whether it's 5, 6, 7, it's really going to be a function of following the data and being data dependent. But the overwhelming priority for the Fed right now has to be to control inflation. And it may require 5 hikes, it may require 7 hikes, it may require more. But they should be guided by the data in determining exactly how many hikes will be needed in the next year.
I see. Okay. Tell us what else we need to know about Amber Waves and what else this audience needs to know about Amber Waves.
Sure. So, you know, what I would say is if your audience hasn't had much exposure to impact investing or, you know, has seen ESG a little bit, but not really felt that it resonated with them. You know, I think what they should be aware of is that we're trying to offer some diversity in the market, right? And we're trying to offer people, exposure to job security and growth rather than, ESG. And so if, ESG doesn't resonate with you, but U.S. job security and growth resonate with you, and you want to make sure your portfolio is aligned with job security and growth, but both because you think that's going to outperform over time and because you believe in the positive impacts associated with job security and growth, then, you know, we might be the right destination for you. And you know, we have one product right now, and you know, an exchange traded fund, IUSA, as I mentioned. But over time, we expect to build out a fulsome product suite, because we're really focused on building a job security and growth, or JSG, ecosystem that can be as large and have as impactful a force on corporate America as ESG has.
Very interesting, very exciting. Tell us once more how people find out more.
Sure. You can go to our website. That's amberwavepartners.com, amberwave.amberwavespartners.com. Or you can see our fund website at jsgfunds.com. You can find all the information about our firm and IUSA there. Or alternatively, you can call your financial advisor or go into your brokerage account and search for the ticker IUSA. And IUSA should be available for purchase wherever you do your investment.
Dan, thank you very much. Delighted to hear about this and great to talk with you. And I hope we talk again soon.
Great to speak with you, Bill. Real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. That does it for today's show. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to thebillbennettshow.com. You can follow me on Twitter at William J. Bennett. You can like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Please share this podcast with your family and friends. We'll catch up next week.